I'm Evan Kleinman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Today, how a cookbook can make your mom cry tears of despair. Also, how Chinese food in America is the most popular and most American of all foods. Plus, a taste of a chow mein sandwich. Jonathan Gold is here, and I've got to show you what a gooey duck clam looks like. I know it's radio, but I'll give it a try. First, let's see what's in season at the legendary Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're visiting with Mark Peel, who is the chef owner of Campanile and who is here at the market every single week. And Mark, as usual, is running around with his staff and his walkie-talkies finding all kinds of great stuff. And Mark, can you give us a little insight as to what you're looking for today and what you might be cooking and help us with a little recipe?
Let's see. We have Mother's Day coming up, which is one of the biggest days of the year in restaurant business, and one of the most important, too, because we have to keep mothers happy, right?
When mama ain't happy, nobody's happy, right?
Happy wife, happy life
right.
is what they say.
Right.
Anyhow, so coming up, so for brunch, we're getting a lot of berries, and the berries are just beautiful right now. Strawberries are at their peak, along with, of course, raspberries and blueberries and blackberries are really coming in strong. But my favorite right now is your good old garden variety strawberry. There's all different kinds of varieties out there, like the seascapes, the gaviotas, the avalons. I love the avalons. They're really firm but really sweet, have great depth of flavor.
And you have to ask the grower. They're not always labeled by variety.
No.
But if you go up and ask, is this is an Avalon, you're going to impress a lot of farmers with your knowledge.
Absolutely. And right. You know what? Farmers love to talk as much as anybody else. So also what's coming up, let's see, Bob Pulido has agretti, which is this, I don't know where it's from, Serbia or Croatia. It's somewhere between an herb and a vegetable. It has kind of a pine needle look to it, but it's really tender, sweet, but with a little bit of a bite, almost a salty, sour bite to it. It's great with stir-fried as a vegetable or tossed with pasta. It's absolutely delicious. I'm getting it every week now, as long as it's in season.
So you just stir-fry it with some garlic or olive oil?
Just a little stir-fry with a little bit of shallots, olive oil, salt and pepper. That's it. Let's see. Oh, morels. Morels are coming into season. They're a little bit tight right now because of high demand because of Mother's Day.
Let's describe what they are and what they look like.
Oh, morels are these delicious wild mushrooms. They look like little wrinkly sponges. You have to wash them well because they grow in sandy soil, so you get all the sand out. And then you cook them long and slow. They're not good raw. They just don't have any flavor.
Mm-hmm.
With a long, slow cooking, they don't turn to mush either. They get this deep, rich, nutty flavor, really, really wonderful, kind of woodsy.
Then you'd use that, say, on a pasta or on, I guess, with anything?
Just about anything. Anything that works with that umami flavor, that rich, savory flavor. I love it with chicken, just chicken breast, because chicken breast doesn't have that much flavor all by itself. If you pair it with morels, it makes it absolutely wonderful.
Do you put the morels in while you're cooking the chicken? They cook all together? Do you like to cook them separate and then add them?
You have to cook them separate because morels take a long, slow cooking. Just a very gentle sauté with olive oil, a touch of garlic. Don't let it burn. So you can add a little touch of water every once in a while, a tablespoon of water, just to keep it at that slow simmer. And the chicken breast can be cooked hot and fast.
All right, and the morels, it grows wild up in the foothills, and it's a seasonal specialty that's just wonderful to get here at the market, too.
It's one of the little side benefits whenever there's a forest fire. Whenever there's a forest fire, the following year there's a lot of morels.
And the morel season, I guess, will go for about 4 to 6 weeks. So jump on it now and get some and sauté them slowly. And
yes.
How do you know when they're done? Do they kind of melt a little or...?
Taste them. It's one of the side benefits of being the cook.
Well, thanks so much, Mark. We love seeing you here every single week.
Thank you.
That was Mark Peel. He's the chef owner of Campanile. He's one of our longest time, most loyal chef shoppers, and we love catching up with him every week and picking his brain. We're visiting now with Rafael Guzman, who comes down from Scott Farms from Dinuba, and he sells, well, right today he's got his first cherries of the season, and he's mobbed at the moment talking to customers. But the Scott Farm is one of the original farmers who was at the Wednesday Farmers Market the day it opened in 1981. And Rafael's been a longtime worker with Scott Farms. And today, Rafael, what kind of cherries?
Brooks cherries.
These are Brooks cherries, and it looks like a Queen Anne. It's like a light red with a yellow tinge to it.
Yes.
And it's an early cherry. Obviously, it's early. The dark purple bings aren't in yet. This is one of the earlier cherries. And I haven't tasted one myself, but he's being mobbed here at the stand. They're going for $5 a pound, which is a real good price this early in the cherry season. And, Rafael, how long are you going to have these cherries?
For sure, 4 weeks.
4 weeks. And then do you have another variety coming?
Another variety is coming.
Which one?
The Tulare.
Tulare. And then?
And Bings.
And Rainier, which are the red and yellow ones that everybody likes so much. And Scott Farms is also well known for having their wonderful stone fruit. They've got peaches, plums, pluots, apriums, plumcots, all that great fruit. But today it's cherry season. Rafael hardly has a minute to talk to us, so we're just going to let him keep working. But the Fish Relay cherries are in. We have three farmers today who have them. We'll have a few more coming. The Bings will be here in a couple of weeks. I just want to remind people also that our library panel at the Santa Monica Main Library is going to be Thursday, May 15th. It's going to feature Mary Sue Milliken, who's our great friend from the Border Grill, also Andy Fisher from Community Food Security Coalition, and farmer Phil McGrath. And they're going to be talking about farm security, local food supplies. So it should be a really good panel, free and open to the public. It's from 7 to 9, Thursday, May 15th. Hope to see everybody there. And, of course, Mary Sue is going to be providing snacks afterwards. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Mother's Day is tomorrow, and if you are as blessed as I am to have a mother around to honor, make sure you choose your gift wisely. I'll be back with two sisters whose gift of a cookbook sent their mother into a spiral of despair. Stay tuned, you children of mothers. I'll be right back on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Wondering what to do for this particular Mother's Day? Well, in honor of that very special woman, we've invited two of our favorite sisters, Marilyn and Sheila Brass, to bring with us a story about their mother, and also maybe to share some of her favorite recipes with us. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning to you.
So tell me a little bit about your mom. Was she a great cook?
Absolutely. Now, that's Sheila talking, and this is Marilyn, but I have to agree completely. She was a fabulous cook, and we must say that she was self-taught after she was married to our father, and all she could make as a sweet young thing before marriage was chocolate cake and brownies.
So I know that when I was growing up, in my case, it was the opposite. My mom was a savory cook and not a sweet cook. So I wanted to have some desserts. So I know that that's when I started realizing that there was such a thing as cookbooks. And I went out and I got my mom a cookbook so that we could actually start to make desserts. Did you have an experience like that where you wanted to give your mother a cookbook so that she would enlarge her repertoire a little?
I would say it's the one and only time we ever did it. And we will tell you the faux pas that we made.
We were two young kids. The year was 1950, Winthrop, Massachusetts, and the two of us saved our pennies. You know, in those days, Evan, a penny could buy something.
And we tootled over to the
spinning wheel, which was a very nice gift shop in Winthrop Center. What we did for Mother's Day in 1950 was to buy a copy of the Betty Crocker Picture Cookbook. And I think that's might be familiar to most people because it's a hardcover, and it has a wonderful illustration on the front in red and cream, like a Pennsylvania Dutch flowering illustration. I'll tell you this, we did wrap it beautifully.
And we presented it to my mother, who was sitting down in a chair, which was fortunate for her. And we waited until she opened it. And then she looked first at Marilyn and then at me. And there were tears in her eyes. And we said, "What's wrong?" And she said, "You don't like the way I cook." And, you know, we of course, we had to console her. We had to encourage her. "Oh, we love your cooking and baking. But we just thought you'd like a cookbook."
Because she only had two cookbooks.
Sheila will describe to you what the Betty Crocker picture cookbook looks like now.
Well, the dust jacket is long gone.
Just have a scrap left.
Right, from the flyleaf. And the spine is hopelessly broken, never to be whole again. But it's just wonderful. It's covered with chocolate on the cover.
So she actually used it.
Right. And she used it and she loved it.
And then the whole family used it because we opened it and we found a handwritten recipe for beef stew that my father had, actually, I had dictated it to him. And we found a copy in his handwriting of the beef stew recipe and my mother's chocolate velvet cake recipe.
I've never heard of a chocolate velvet cake.
Well, you have now.
Describe it for us.
It's a three-layer chocolate cake, rich dark chocolate, and it has about an inch of frosting on the top.
And in between the layers, too.
And my mother used to toast walnuts, coarsely chopped walnuts, and pat them onto the frosting, you know, around the sides. And we have a very funny story about that cake. The old black cast iron and green enamel stove in the kitchen in Winthrop had a fault. And the fault was that it always baked things at an angle. It could have been the floor. And my mother would do every time she made the chocolate velvet cake was to build up the frosting on one side of the cake.
So it would be level.
Be level. And, of course, after a while, Sheila and I and our cousins and our friends got smart. And we always tried to get a piece of cake from the side that had been built up. One side would have like 3/4 inch, and the other side would have 1.5 inches of frosting on the top. So, you know, we were smart kids. But I have to tell you, my mother also made the most wonderful strudel. It was made with a wonderful cream cheese pastry, and it had dried apricots. And, you know, she rolled the strudel dough very thin, and then she rolled the filling, you know, in the middle and everything. And, you know, the only way I can describe it, it sort of looked, it looked like Jewish sushi, you know, when you cut the pieces.
Like a salmon roll.
Exactly.
Yeah, yes. And then Sheila will tell you, remember the other strudel? This was another form of Jewish sushi. Tell Evan about the apple strudel.
Oh, well, my mother also made apple strudel, which was absolutely wonderful. But this was not as narrow as the apricot strudel. This was wide, and it was so crisp. It was flaky. It would just melt in your mouth. You would, you know, wet your fingers and go around the table to pick up all the little crumbs and things. And then she'd sprinkle a little powdered sugar on top.
It was heaven. It was heaven. It was dessert heaven. And, you know, I am a writer, and I like to fantasize and imagine. And I'm trying to imagine what
heaven would be like.
No, dessert heaven.
Oh.
I think we'd probably have our own little clouds, and they would be sort of composed of powdered sugar and meringue. And people would sort of live on these clouds, and they go to visit each other on each other's clouds. And, you know, maybe they'd have a hide a cloud so people could stay over and have breakfast. But, you know, you'd be able to eat anything you wanted, especially, you know, like an extra piece of chocolate velvet cake. And you could sneak in an extra, you know, piece of Jewish sushi, a.k.a. apricot strudel. And you know what would be great? Not only would it taste good and bring back wonderful memories, but they'd have no calories. You would never have to worry in heaven about putting on weight.
You know what I think is heaven?
What?
Spending some time with the two of you. Thank you so much, Marilyn and Sheila. You have been just a pleasure.
Well, it's our pleasure,
right, too. Back at you.
The Brass Sisters are a hoot. and they have a PBS show called The Brass Sisters, Queens of Comfort Food. Details on their show and their mom's favorite recipes online at kcrw.com/goodfood. A lot of moms have secret recipes. You know, the ones they swear to take to their graves. Well, is it okay to keep a recipe a secret or keep out a key ingredient? We'll get the proper protocol next with etiquette columnist Helena Eichlin. Are you one of those people who has a secret recipe that you just won't share with anyone? Or are you open-fisted? Do you have a recipe that you'll give out to anyone, but maybe you just forget one critical ingredient? Is it okay to keep a recipe secret even among friends? We've asked Helena Eichlin from Chow.com's Table Matters column to give us her opinion. Hi, Helena.
Hi, Evan.
I love this subject because I feel like I'm not allowed to have any secret recipes.
Well, I think in this day and age, people really balk at the idea of a secret recipe because they're used to, with the internet, being able to have like million recipes available at the click of a mouse. And so they can't fathom it when you say, no, I'm afraid I can't give this recipe out.
But as a restaurateur, I sort of feel like, you know, when people ask for a recipe, I'll give it to them because I've learned over time that a recipe is much more than just the words on the paper. And there have, of course, been those famous experiences where I think the New York Times once I gave the same recipe to 12 or 13 different bakers and each cake came out completely different.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious. I know that you had an experience with a restaurant where you asked for a recipe and what happened?
It was Papalote, which is a Mexican place in here in San Francisco. And they have an incredible salsa. It's sort of like very charred and smoky tasting. But what makes it really amazing is it's very creamy. And it has what I call excellent chip grip, because most salsas, or many salsas, when you dip the chip in the salsa, a lot of the salsa falls off and you're left with this chip that's kind of got some like watery tomato bits clinging to it. But when you dip a chip in the papalote salsa, the entire chip is like uniformly coated. But it also just has this amazing rich taste. So I asked the guys that own the restaurant if I could have the recipe. And they said, no, it's a family recipe. Maybe you can have it for $300,000. So then I went to just these incredible lengths. I had all these ideas, like maybe I should hire someone to go and work in the kitchen as a spy. And then I decided that I would try to get the salsa's DNA analyzed. So I called all these labs, and because I wanted to get a breakdown of the ingredients, and I called the CEO of this biotech company, and he was like, yeah, you could get the DNA of this salsa analyzed. There's one lab in the world that does it in the Netherlands, and it'll cost $1 million. Because they'd have to map the chili genome in order to analyze the salsa's ingredients. So I gave up on that. And then I just did the old-fashioned reverse engineering where you just try like a million different variations until you crack it. So I like sieved the salsa because it was pureed and then inspected all these little specks and tried to figure out what kind of chili they were and were these scallions or onions. And then I worked with the chef at Chow and we made like, I don't know, even know how many variations until we came up with one that we thought was actually really superlative.
And do you keep that a secret?
I do keep it secret because I've always been really jealous of those families where they like have a secret family recipe, you know, that's been handed down through generations. So I decided I want to have one of those recipes in my family. I'll just be the first person to hand it down. I'll be the person who's like on my deathbed and says, this is my salsa recipe. You must never share it.
That That's so funny because, you know, I have no secret recipes. I mean, what do you think about if somebody hands you a recipe, but there's some key ingredient missing? I think that's worse than saying, no, I won't give you the recipe.
Well, it depends if they tell you whether the ingredient is missing or not. Like if they don't tell you and you just can't understand why their recipe isn't working, that seems a bit underhand. But if they just say, look, this is my secret recipe. On his deathbed, my father made me swear never to reveal it to a living soul outside the family. So I can't give it to you as it is, but I'll give it to you without, you know, with one thing changed.
What is the etiquette solution to this situation? If someone asks you for a recipe and you don't want to share, how can you handle it gracefully without offending them?
Well, I think you should definitely bring up a dead relative because you can't really say, I mean, maybe I should fabricate a dead relative who gave me this as a recipe, because if you say on his deathbed, my father told me never to reveal this, they can't really argue with that. And then just in the future, every so often you can give them a gift of the salsa or cake or eggnog or whatever it is. And the gift is so much more special because it's your secret recipe. Like, here's a jar of my secret salsa is something that everybody wants to hear.
Helena Eichlund is the etiquette columnist for Chow Magazine Online. I've got links to her article at kcrw.com/goodfood. Go to the new Good Food blog and give us your opinion on secret recipes. Maybe you've got one. Let us know. KCRW.com/goodfood. Clay and food and puppets. They all come together in one of the cutest food shows to come to video. More on that next when Good Food continues on KCRW and KCRW.com. What do you get when you cross animation, people, puppets, and food? Yummy Fun. Claire Crespo's the creator of the show Yummy Fun, now on DVD. And today she's going to give us a glimpse into her very wonderful, wacky world and tell us about the amazing things she creates with food. I have to say that the first time I saw just the trailer, not even the whole video, I was like, oh my gosh, you're going to be the new Pee-wee Herman.
Oh, but, that's so nice.
But less scary and all about food.
Yes. Well, it definitely has that. It is that world of like puppets and animation and music and grown-ups and kids and, you know.
Yeah, grown-ups, children, and inanimate and animated objects coming together in a kooky celebration of food.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the food. What are some of the fun foods that you're making for spring?
So the episode Spring is Sprung, which is the first episode, in the episode I make three recipes. One is potato flip-flops,
The Shoe of Spring, which is from one of your books. And I remember the first time I saw the picture, I thought, oh, that is the most brilliant thing ever. Describe these flip-flops.
They are roasted potato slices, you know, the whole slice with the skin, and roasted in the oven for a little bit with some olive oil. Then they have two green beans that are the straps.
So the foot part, the rubber base of the shoe,
is a potato.
And then the thongs, the things you stick your toes through, are green beans.
And you can sprinkle a little rosemary on top, and then it looks like your flip-flops have been walking through the grass. Just also good seasoning for the potato flip-flop. But
when children are confronted with these, how delighted are they?
Well, it's pure fantasy, and it's vegetables, so it's like everybody wins.
Do they actually immediately pick off a green bean and start eating it?
Sure. But the trick is, and I've made this mistake before, you have to serve them in pairs. Like it just doesn't make sense when there's just one sitting on your, which means more vegetables to eat. On the other end of the spectrum, candy bugs is also in the
Well,
episode.
I know you love candy bugs, and you're so good at creating them.
Well, they're just such a good art project, you know.
So in the Yummy Fun Kitchen, how are you making the bugs?
Well, we first go to the garden of Green Charlotte, who is one of the characters, and she sort of grows all the produce, etc., in her little terrarium.
She's like Mr. Green Jeans?
Yes, yes.
I love that.
But she has a little terrarium that she grows, and she, in this episode, has a little tree that has all the candy on it. And then we make these bugs on the show. But, of course, the bugs come alive and buzz, and, you know, we end up having a parade with the bugs through her garden. You know, it's all ridiculous and crazy.
What are the bugs made from?
They're a dough that is powdered sugar and condensed milk. It's just like Play-Doh. It gets hard sitting in the air, and then you decorate them with a little bit of royal icing and any small candies that you can pick from your tree.
And do you sometimes also color the dough that you make?
Sure. And you can use nuts or seeds or, you know, sort of any art supply.
What do you use for legs and tentacles?
If you were making, for example, like a caterpillar or millipede style bug, I like those little chocolate jimmies, those little long jimmies. Those are really great legs.
and eye whiskers, those weird
little
like,
antennas, a little licorice, or, you know, I think that's a really fun part is going to the 7-Eleven or the candy shop and sort of looking for supplies that inspire you, you know.
You know, food is always a wonderful thing to nurture people and share with people, but doing craft with food takes that just one step farther.
Right.
And it's delightful, I have to say. Using that word, it's not a word you use a lot, but this particular yummy fun cooking is delightful.
Well, thanks.
Well, thank you, Claire, for
coming.
Thank
you, Evan.
It's been a pleasure, as always.
As always.
Claire Crespo is the creator of YummyFun.com. I've got info on how to purchase these really inventive DVD cooking shows at kcrw.com/goodfood. My next guest is a wonder of nature. There's no other way to say it. He's 70, and if you saw his body, you'd think it belonged to a bodybuilding 30-year-old. The way he got it, though, is through a concept called uniform eating. What that is next when Good Food returns. Get ready to take notes. That's coming up on KCRW and KCRW.com. Are you fed up with having to constantly come up with meal ideas that satisfy you while meeting your ever more arcane diet requirements? Well, you might want to try out the idea of uniform eating. This is an idea of the extremely ripped and mighty fine Clarence Bass. He's pretty much the poster man for anything having to do with fitness and diet, since he just may be the most buff man of his age around. First of all, before we get into talking about the subject, how old are you right now?
I'm 70 years old.
And what is your percentage of body fat?
About 6%.
How is that compared to about a decade ago?
It's about the same.
Wow. How have you managed to maintain that kind of steadiness in your physique?
Well, it is mainly just that, by being regular in your training and regular in what you eat.
What is uniform eating?
Well, uniform eating is what it sounds like. It's eating the same thing from day to day.
Share with us what your eating regime is.
Well, the idea of eating the same thing from day to day is so you can monitor your calories without actually counting. The key to making that work is eating foods that fill you up without giving you too many calories and eating on a regular basis so you stay ahead of your hunger curve. The way I do that is I start with a substantial breakfast. I think that's very important. It's cooked whole grains. It's a mixture of fruits, which I get frozen. It's also a mixture of vegetables, which I also get frozen. And it's topped with soy milk. And I also add a little ground flaxseed. And I put it in the microwave for about 5 minutes. and we're ready to go.
So let's say, just as a guess, you might have millet or spelt.
I usually have a combination of four or five grains. Favorites are oat groats, hulled barley, amaranth, and kamut.
I love all that stuff. It has such a great, satisfying chewing feeling.
You put your finger on a very important point. People are more satisfied if they eat something that they have to chew.
Now, a lot of people, on hearing that you're eating all those grains, might think that they're very strong tasting. But in fact, this blend you've put together is kind of mild and nice, kind of nutty, maybe.
It is, absolutely. Actually, it's a pretty neutral taste.
Now, do you just throw the frozen things right on there and then microwave them?
Yes. I make up the grain, say, about a week in advance. So you can't be cooking grain all the time. It takes a while to make it. So it's all ready to go when I get up in the morning. And then I add the flaxseed after that. And I also add about a teaspoon of sugar, or it could be an artificial sweetener like Sweet and Low. But it's very important that the foods that you eat taste good, that you enjoy them. So people shouldn't hesitate to have a teaspoon of sugar in there. There's nothing wrong with a teaspoon of sugar.
And now give us an idea of what you eat for lunch.
Lunch is a little simpler. Simply an almond or a peanut butter sandwich on nice whole grain bread. And then maybe a mixture of yogurt and soy milk, which is a very nice complement to the nut flavor. And then maybe some sliced carrots.
And then what about dinner?
Dinner varies, but I like to start out with a really big salad. My wife is a wonderful salad maker, and she makes the salads in the morning. So the salad is ready there for me. It has avocado and tomatoes and just a lot of different colors in it. And along with the salad, I have another nice piece of bread. And then I either have fish, chicken, or maybe several eggs. I like the fish with the higher fat, like salmon. We're not trying to make this a hair shirt thing. We're trying to make it a really enjoyable, filling meal, and it truly is.
Do you ever find yourself craving an omelet or French toast?
Well, that's a good question. And if I did, I would have an omelet or French toast. If you tell yourself you can't have something, then it's just human nature that you want it. But if you tell yourself you can have practically anything you want, and this breakfast meal, it's not set in stone. It's not that I've been eating the same thing for 30 years, even though I have been eating some variation of that for 30 years. But if I had a craving for an omelet or maybe eggs for breakfast or even pancakes, I would do it.
You know, when most people hear that someone is eating pretty much the same foods every day, they might find that a little unappealing. How do you get around that?
Well, I know that's absolutely true. And when I first wrote about it in my book published in 1980 called Ripped, I acknowledge that some people are probably not going to want to do this. But the key is, as I said at the beginning, to eat foods that you enjoy. And the other key is to stay ahead of your hunger curve. So that's why I have a mid-morning snack. I have a mid-afternoon snack. I eat again before I go to bed. I'm keeping my blood sugar on an even keel. So when I get to a meal, I feel in control and I know I'm going to follow the plan.
Clarence Bass is an incredible specimen of the human form. I have a picture of his extremely beautiful cut torso at kcrw.com/goodfood, plus a link to his method of uniform eating. There's a clam out there called a gooey duck, and there's only one way to describe it, but that happens to be a bit too racy for this show. I'll put it this way. They look like a part of the male anatomy, exactly like it, and people eat them. My next guest spent time with these clams and those who harvest them. He'll tell us about his documentary on these clams when Good Food returns. That's in 1 minute, right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com.
Thank you.
are certain foods that require, well, a leap of faith after you first take a look at them in their natural state. Often these foods inspire devotion amongst those who consume and revere them. Take the gooey duck. If you've never seen one, then just imagine an extremely well-formed male member with one end sandwiched in a clamshell. That's the gooey duck. They're somewhat shocking, actually, to behold. Justin Bookie became a gooey duck devotee early in life, inducted into its secrets on clam-digging summer vacations. He grew up to direct a documentary of the awesome animals called 3 Feet Under, Digging Deep for the Gooey Duck Clam. So where do gooey ducks come from?
They're home pretty much exclusively to the Pacific Northwest, but the real zone and the real sweet spot for getting gooey ducks is Puget Sound in Washington State and also British Columbia.
And that's where, I mean, there's schools that have mascots.
That's right. Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington has the gooey duck as the mascot. My sister went there. That matches the school perfectly because it's a iconoclastic school. It doesn't have the roaring cougar or the tiger as the mascot. It's a very low-level, sedentary, but also you could think of it as an intellectual, calm, and pensive creature. And they like that image. The president of Evergreen State College himself says, it's a creature that you have to dig deep to appreciate and you have to really think about to appreciate.
Describe the process of getting a gooey duck. In one of the photographs on the website for your documentary, I saw this open-ended can.
A gooey duck gun.
Is that what that's called, a gooey duck gun? Okay, describe the process from when you first know where to go.
First of all, there's only 2 or 3 days of the year that the tide is low enough to go gooey ducking recreationally because they're in the intertidal zone. And they're so clammed out on most public beaches that you have to go to the very, very lowest tides of the year. And you look for a gooey duck show, it's called, where the neck is just barely poking up past the surface of the sand. There's a little dimple. You have to distinguish that show between several other types of gooey duck shows. There's horse clam shows.
So how do you know that? Do you touch it and then the siphon just spews out?
Yeah, well, you don't have to touch it because once you know the show, you know it's there. And you just have to get ready to dig literally 3 feet down into the sand. There's a lot of different techniques, but one of the more efficient techniques is to have a gooey duck gun, which is a metal or plastic cylinder, roughly 3 feet long. You find the gooey duck show. You position the clam gun over it, and you wedge it down. You dig in the inside. You wedge it down some more. Maybe a half hour or an hour later, you might get to this gooey duck. And sometimes they're even so far down, you can't even reach them. And the tide's coming in. You're pretty soon submerged in water. And if you're lucky enough, you wiggle that thing loose because it's in a kind of a vacuum down there, and it's hard to get out. And you come home with a prize gooey duck.
How old are they when you find them? How long can they be?
The oldest gooey duck on record lived to be 163 years old.
So should we feel bad about resting something that survived that long out of the ocean?
Yeah, well, like any fish, its life can be interrupted
by predators.
By predators, including humans. It is amazing to think that there is a gooey duck out there right now that was alive when Lincoln was in the White House.
That's just extraordinary. Now, I also understand that the shells have this tree ring thing where you can actually count how old they are.
Yeah, they're referred to as the tree rings of the ocean. You can actually measure climactic variations, water temperature variations. 100 years ago, by reading into the rings of the gooey duck shell, you can actually measure when there were nuclear testings going on in the Pacific based on the carbon buildups in the gooey duck shell.
So how do they begin? Take us through the lifespan of a gooey duck.
Well, the eggs and the sperm are basically released in the water maybe once a year. And they swim around, they join up, and little baby gooey ducks swim around for maybe a month or two. And then they finally find a nice sandy spot in the ocean floor and dig down with a little foot, and they pretty much pick out their home for the next century or so.
So they find a little spot, they stick themselves in, and that's where they are.
Yeah.
Amazing. That's just amazing.
And the neck reaches up and filters algae through the water. And once they're about 5 years old, they're commercially viable to sell. They might be 3 or 5 pounds. And they reach full size maybe 15 or 20 years of age.
And what is full size? A lot of people will, you know, they imagine a neck that goes in and out, but these necks are like permanently exposed, shall we say.
They do extend and retract, but it's one of the few clams where the neck is just so big it'll never fit into the shell. So when it is fully extended, it reaches all the way to the top of its hole and it sucks nutrients out of the water. When it gets scared, it retracts all the way down almost into the shell, and then there's no way to see it from the surface of the sand.
And is the whole thing edible?
Yeah. Well, most of it. You generally throw the guts out, but there are two main parts to eat, which are very different. So the neck is really good sliced as sashimi, thin slices, and you can run it through a little soy and ginger.
What does it taste like?
It's crunchy but fairly tender. And it has a very sweet, almost abalone slash lobster type of flavor, which really is in distinct contrast to its nasty appearance. It's some would say it's beautiful. It's certainly phallic, but it can be wrinkled and gray on the outside. It doesn't look too appetizing, perhaps, but boy.
Do you peel off the...
There's a certain skin. There's a little outer skin that you peel off. And then the rest of the flesh is actually quite appealing. The inner part or the breast part of the body within the shell is actually very tender. So you can cut that up easily and put it in a stir fry and it works perfectly. So if you order the dish in a Chinese restaurant, often you'll get two very different dishes. One is a bed of sashimi on ice and the other is a wonderful stir fry concoction.
So Justin, is there anywhere here in Los Angeles County that you know about where we could find gui duck on the menu?
Sure. In general, Chinese restaurants will serve it when they can get it. You might need to ask for elephant trunk clam. That's the direct translation from Chinese. But when they get them in very small quantities often.
Are they really expensive?
Oh, yeah. They're such a prized creature now. They can go for $15, $20 a pound wholesale when supplies are
tight. So by the time it reaches your plate, you're talking about almost $100.
In Hong Kong, definitely. Here, it might be a little cheaper.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Go to kcrw.com/goodfood to see a picture of the gui duck clam and to learn more about my guest, Justin Bookie. We'll also have a link to his documentary there. I know a man who's eaten gui ducks and more clam varieties than I knew existed. It's Pulitzer Prize-winning food critic Jonathan Gold. He's here next to tell us about his latest food find. Stay tuned. Good Food on KCRW. We'll be right back. Jonathan Gold is with me this morning. Of course, Jonathan writes counterintelligence columns for the LA Weekly and has been rewarded with the Pulitzer Prize for doing so. We're going, I think, somewhere atypical for us this morning.
We're going to La Mille in Silver Lake.
Now, what is La Mille?
La Mille is originally a brand of very high-quality coffee. You know, it's largely organic. It's all from... you know, very individual farms as opposed to from areas. They procure the stuff and they roast it in a style that is extremely appealing to coffee people. And to
what does that mean?
Their roasts are light and the coffees are generally very winey.
I love their coffee. It isn't that one size dark fits all.
Yeah. I mean,
much more nuanced.
Sometimes I don't feel quite holy enough to drink their coffee. And sometimes the person who calls himself the coffee savant of La Mille is like completely excited about things in coffee that other people may not be as excited about. Like this Kenyan coffee that he loves that has a very pronounced flavor of hot tomato soup.
I don't know that that would be a good thing for me in a cup of coffee.
If you know it's coming, it's okay. If you don't know it's coming, man, is it a shock. And the hazelnutty, chocolatey things you expect. But yeah, sometimes the tomato soup or the blueberries or the one of them has like a real sort of cedar thing going on. It's different coffee than you've had before. In a way, he describes it as the difference between, say, drinking Gallo's Hardy Burgundy and drinking like a really nice Pinot Noir. One of them has the sense of terroir and the sense of the grape and the sense of everything going on. And the other one is a nice glass of red wine.
So La Mille has opened in Silver Lake, and it's a little cafe as well. It's not just a coffee place.
It's not just a coffee place. For one thing, you can get your coffees in one of any of, you know, eight or so different ways. And
some, in terms of how it's brewed.
In terms of how it's brewed. So you can get espresso, and you can get coffee made from the, you know, super expensive clover machines, and you can get coffee made from the Chemex pot. You can get coffee made in an old-fashioned siphon pot, and you can get coffee.
So what do you choose when you go there?
I love this method called Eva Solo.
It sounds like a James Bond character.
It looks like a James Bond character. It's this glass carafe that comes in what I can only call a form-fitting neoprene jumpsuit to insulate it. Somebody puts it on your table and they set a timer clicking down from 2 minutes, click, 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 just like, you know, it was a time bomb waiting to come off. And then the exact second that the beep happens, somebody comes over and, you know, sexily pulls down the big zipper on the neoprene thing, takes out a sort of paddle, stirs it around the coffee to break the crust, and then plunges this long conical mesh things that looks like, you know, one of the bras that Madonna wore on her and in the 80s tours, and plunges it into the coffee. And it's supposed to be much closer to the cupping experience than you can get any other way. And the coffee is very clear and very strong. And it doesn't have any of the sediment that you expect in like a French press. I don't know if it's just me, but it seems to sort of maximize the caffeine content. So by the time you're out of there, you are just absolutely like floating on caffeine. One of the things that's strange about this place is that they also have an extremely ambitious and well-realized menu, which is done by Michael Cimarusti of Providence and Adrian Vasquez, his pastry chef.
His pastry chef, who's extraordinary.
He's amazing.
Do they have some of his confections there?
They do. They have a lot of them, and they're very, very close to what he does at Providence. I mean, they're missing a lot of the sort of three-star garnishes and stuff, but
I can't think of anything nicer than going and having an extraordinarily well-made cup of coffee and just sitting and eating a plate of chocolates.
Right. They also serve those peculiar liquid lollipops. Have you had those?
No, I haven't had those.
It's like a hard shell of chocolate or white chocolate, and you bite into it, and it has something like spiced passion fruit juice inside that just like explodes.
But there's also a whole savory menu.
There's also a whole savory menu. There are things that you wouldn't expect, like cured Tasmanian sea trout, you know, this beautiful sort of carpaccio presentation, you know, topped with, you know, creme fraiche and, you know, dice thingies and these tiny little crunchy balls that all the hip pastry chefs are using these days. And crumbled wasabi peas on it for like that little wasabi thing. It's really good. And when you consider that you're paying like $12 for it, I mean, it's maybe the best food you can get for that price point anywhere in town. It's great. They don't have alcohol, so you're drinking coffee with it.
They have other things besides coffee. They have a great tea menu too.
They have a great tea menu. They make a couple dozen teas. And if you're interested in stuff, somebody will come over and tell you more about any coffee or tea than you would need to get your master's thesis in. These guys are into it.
This has been great fun talking about La Mille. Thank you very much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer Jonathan Gold's with us often on Good Food. Find his past recommendations at kcrw.com/goodfood. You'll find our Good Food blog there, too, and you can tell us your favorite food finds. I'd love to hear where you're eating. If you're eating Chinese food, you might be surprised to know that your favorite dishes in the Chinese restaurant may be as foreign as cheese pizza to Chinese in China. The evolution of Chinese food in America when Good Food returns. That's next on KCRW, and you're listening to Good Food.
Is Chinese food in America an ethnic cuisine, or is it just something uniquely ours, as American as apple pie? With us to talk about it is Jennifer Ait Lee, the author of The Fortune Cookie Chronicles. So, Jenny, I understand that one of your big inspirations for taking this voyage into Chinese American cookery and culture was the strange Powerball lottery in which so many people won and they all had found their number through a fortune cookie.
I was on the subway when I read a tiny little article about the fact that Powerball had this inordinate number of second place winners because so many of them had played numbers from fortune cookie. And so I became determined to track those fortune cookies all the way back to the factory they came from and along the way explore the story of fortune cookies backwards, because that is the story of Chinese restaurants told forward.
You took off on this journey and you went through 42 states. What are some of the generalizations that you were able to make about the way Americans interact with Chinese food?
A lot of the food that Americans think of as, quote, Chinese is actually not recognized by people from China and is largely indigenous to America. It's what I call indigenous ethnic cuisine. And two, you know, the kinds of things that Americans eat in terms of Chinese food and food in general tends to veer towards more fried, more sweet, more meaty than Chinese food, which has a lot more vegetables, a lot more seafood. So you see that in chop suey. You see that in a dish called General Tso's chicken, which of course is all but unknown in China. You see that in fortune cookies, which are also all but unknown in China. And even beef with broccoli, which is not actually a Chinese dish, because broccoli is an Italian vegetable that became popular in America in the 1920s and 1930s. It's not a Chinese vegetable. I guarantee you that General Tso never saw a stalk of broccoli in his life.
There seems to be this myth that the Chinese food that we eat in America started with the immigrants who came over to build the railroads and that there wasn't any Chinese ingredients available to them. So they did a sort of bastardized version for themselves and then it sort of went on like a game of telephone to please the American palate. But you think differently.
Yeah. If anything, the Chinese immigrant workers who came here in the mid-1800s bent over backwards to get Chinese ingredients brought over from China. I mean, they had tofu, they had sesame oil, they had shark fin, they had bird's nest. I mean, there are sort of stories in magazines and newspapers about all these exotic things that would come off the boats. You know, it's my theory, actually, that what has ended up in Chinese restaurants is a very conscious attempt by Chinese restaurateurs to cater to the American palate in terms of everything from crab rangoon, which is basically cream cheese wonton and a little bit bizarre, to General Tso's chicken, to egg rolls, which are actually not Chinese. Chinese have spring rolls, but egg rolls are like more pimply and larger. They're what I consider the original supersize me. You can see what they eat at, you know, 3 p.m. after the lunch crowds sort of disperse, and what they are eating is different from what they are serving to their customers. And they know it. I mean, it's sort of this big inside joke.
Well, first of all, probably what they're eating has eyes or feet or
yes,
or fins, mm-hmm, or some of the parts that Americans seem to get kind of squeamish. We don't like to know that our food was ever alive.
Exactly. I mean, it definitely, Chinese people are definitely about like using the whole animal.
Tell me a little bit about how you started to feel when you realized that Chinese food to Americans was almost American. I mean, it was just such an important part of their monthly diet.
Yeah. At a certain point, I had this little epiphany, which is if our benchmark for Americans is apple pie, you know, how often do Americans eat apple pie and how often do they eat Chinese food? And, you know, a tiny little side note is we think of McDonald's as all American and apple pie is all American. But if you go to McDonald's to order apple pie, it looks like an egg roll.
Also, you mentioned how many Chinese restaurants there are in America compared to all the fast food restaurants combined.
Yeah, there are more Chinese restaurants in this country than McDonald's, Burger King, and Kentucky Fried Chicken's combined.
You managed to visit the factory where they make those wonderful little crispy noodles. And mm-hmm, there were boxes flying off the conveyor belts going to how many? Every state, right?
Yeah, there is a factory in Falls River, Massachusetts that makes chow mein sandwich mixes, which is a taste of home.
What is
it? Yeah, it
is.
It is bizarre. It is bizarre, but wonderful. It is beautiful in its bizarreness. It is basically a starch on starch sandwich with gravy and onions and celery. And it is popular in southeastern New England, so parts of Rhode Island, parts of Massachusetts. And you know those crispy fried noodles that we get, which of course Chinese people don't eat in China? Imagine that. With like a brownish, gravy-ish sauce of indeterminate origins on either a hamburger bun or Wonder Bread. It is both horrifying and beautiful.
I love that. I love that. For one last little tidbit, tell me where the little white boxes come from.
They mostly come from three factories. A lot of them are owned by a company called Foldpak. And these boxes, which we think of as Chinese, were actually invented in America to hold shucked oysters. And they are so American that the Canadians don't even use them. But the rest of the world sees these boxes mostly in one place. That's American movies and American television shows. So they associate it with the United States because they see it in Friends, in Seinfeld, and in Sex and the City. And so they try to buy these boxes as a way to celebrate, you know, an American party, for example, from, you know, if they're in the Netherlands or in South Africa.
Isn't that funny? Well, I have to say that your book and your blog both are so filled with information. I definitely hope to speak to you again. That was Jennifer Eightley. She's a New York Times reporter, and she's the author of The Fortune Cookie Chronicles. We'll have a link to the book and to her website on our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can find info in today's show, watch the latest video on leaks, and download this show and past episodes online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Please write me at goodfood@kcrw.com. I'll write you back, I promise. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced by Thea Challoner with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Holly Tarson. The music supervisor is Gary Messihan. Special thanks to Karen Soriano, Jessica Spaulding, and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleinman. Tune in next week for another edition of Good Food.